All right. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Carol Ridley, coordinator for the Herring River Restoration Project, and I'd like to welcome you to this December 19th meeting of the Herring River Executive Council. And as a first order of business, I would invite our Executive Council members present to kindly introduce themselves. Jen, do you want to start us off?
Sure, good afternoon. I'm Jennifer Flynn. I serve as the superintendent for Cape Cod National Seashore.
And Jeff?
Hi, everyone. Jeff Sanders, Division Chief for Natural Resource Management and Science at Cape Cod National Seashore.
Helen Miranda Wilson, appointee from the town of Wellfleet. I've been in it since it started, the Herring River Executive Council. Thank you.
Thank you. And Janet Reinhart is also a member representing Wellfleet. I do not see Janet yet this afternoon, but she may yet join us. But we are ready to get underway. And our first order of business is the approval of the minutes of October 31, 2024, which can be accomplished by consensus. So I would invite the members to indicate your pleasure as to the minutes of October 31st.
Helen, it looks good to me.
Yeah, this is Jeff. I just found a couple one minor typo, Carol, but I don't think it doesn't reflect anything about the content, so I'm fine.
Very good.
And Carol, if you don't need a quorum, I'll abstain because I wasn't at the meeting. But I assume that they are an accurate reflection. But do you need three votes?
I think we would need three.
We're not voting.
Well, it's true. It's a consensus of the members present. So technically, I guess we wouldn't. Okay. So we'll accept the minutes by consensus. Okay. So I guess that works. Perfect. All right. We'll move right into updates of the Herring River Restoration Project. So I'll share some slides here. And let me just ask you all if you can see this. Is it in presentation mode?
Yes.
Not yet.
Not yet in
Helen,
presentation.
yes.
Yes, or I see.
We can see the slides, but it's the there you go. Now we
Yep.
see,
Now you
now it's
see
presentation.
the full mode. Okay, super. All right. Let me just see if I can advance to the next slide. All right. Well, just a quick overview of our agenda for this afternoon. Following the updates on the project itself, we'll have a discussion on project archiving and data management, which was a request made at the last Executive Council meeting. We also will discuss secondary access to Griffin Island properties, which also was requested as an agenda item at the last meeting. We have some business to attend to with respect to the stakeholder group and some appointments for your consideration. We've been asked by a member to add correspondence to the agenda as a regular agenda item, so we'll touch on that just very briefly. Some correspondence was provided to Executive Council members prior to the meeting. We'll share that. Then, as a regular standing item, any announcement that members wish to make, followed by a public comment period. So with that, we'll move right into project updates, and I'm happy to welcome Wes Stinson with Environmental Partners to give us an update on the bridge project. Welcome, Wes.
Thanks, Carol. So to give an update on the bridge project, right now to date, we're at a contract sum of $31.3 million. We've completed by way of cost, $16 million of that, or roughly 51%. Of that $31.3 million, $1.48 million have been through change orders. And we're currently in the stage 2B, or the southern bay of construction, which can be seen in the red outline in the plans below. You can flip the slide, Carol, if you don't mind. So just to do a quick run through of how we've gotten to where we are. The first year, we're roughly 91, 92 weeks into construction right now. That first year was really tied up in construction of the temporary bridge. And then there was a little lag time while we waited for the utilities to get brought over the temporary bridge so we could get on the existing dike. But once we got going in earnest on construction of the permanent bridge, which took place in the spring of 2024, we started with that 2B coffer cell. We started with excavation, establishing the sheet lines, getting that down to elevation, which is -9, that you can see in the right photo. That's the base elevation of all our footings. You can move on. Next one, Carol. Once we got all the excavation completed, we installed piles. There's approximately 87 piles in that coffer cell that underlay all the footings. Then we started to do all the rebar and concrete work, which saw the construction of the pier. You can see Pier 2 here, and you can see the footing work getting started on the southern abutment. Once we completed the concrete work, we started to do the channel armor stone, which you can see on the left-hand photo. We installed about 3-foot diameter stone that was intermingled with existing fill from the site to create the channel armor. And we also started to place the bridge beams and the gate panels at the site, which, that just occurred this month. So we can flip to the next slide. And one of the big milestones that we're seeing right now or coming up to is the installation of these water controlled gate panels, which is really it's the meat and potatoes of this project and what's going to control the tide once we start to get there. So those all went in this past week. We have 5 of them installed. If you look at both these photos, you can see the 6-foot wide by 10-foot high clear openings. Those are going to get water control gates installed over them that can be adjusted. So we're in the process of doing that. And we're really coming up onto the next big phase, which is going to be stage 3. We can flip to the next slide, Carol. So this is kind of the real crux of what we're about to get through right now. So if you look at the top profile view of the bridge, you can see on the right-hand side with the colored gates, that's stage 2. And that's what we've been working on for, since this spring. And we're going to be, once we trans, we're going to be, when we complete phase 2, moving to what's outlined in the red box, which is stage 3 of construction. And that's essentially going to see the construction of all the rest of the permanent bridge. It's going to be both the Northern Bay, the Middle Bay, Pier 1, and the Northern Abutment. In order to make that transition though, we need to, per the permit requirements, mimic existing flow, and transition that flow from the existing culverts that you can see in the photos below to the newly constructed southern bay that was built in stage 2. If you look at the photos on the bottom, you can see that existing, we have 2 flap gates, which are the far left photo, and the green dot, that's essentially what you're seeing underneath these 2 rectangles in the middle photo. And then we have 1 sluice gate on the right in blue that's opened roughly 18 to 24 inches high. And that gate has been seized up and locked in place for many, many years, as many of you obviously know. So as we transition to stage 3 of construction, we're going to need to, mimic that flow. So we're in the far right photo, you can see the 5 gate panels. And how we're going to do that essentially is to take the 2 flap gates that are in green on the left and do 2 combination flap gates on the right. And then we're going to do a solid stop gate in blue and keep that opening at the prescribed 18 to 24 inches. And what we intend on doing is opening that probably at the lower end, probably start at 18 inches. We're going to be monitoring our water elevations, both upstream and downstream, ensure we're seeing similar tidal exchanges, and then make any adjustments as necessary to achieve that. So right now we're in the process of putting together a submittal, or MIG is, and Fussin O'Neill, the engineer, and ourselves to submit not only to the engineer, but also to the regulatory agencies. So we've submitted that for a preliminary review to the DEP, and we've submitted it to DMF, Department of Marine Fisheries, to get their comments. We are gonna take those comments, try to flesh out the final submittal and get to them that to them early in January for their final review. And pending a successful review from the agencies, we'll get that back and see this transition happening in ideally mid-February is what we're shooting for. So in mid-February, we should see that flow cease from the existing culvert, shift to the southern bay of stage 2 work. At which time MIG's going to effectively take the work that they did in stage 2 and mirror it on stage 3. So that's where we stand. It's pretty exciting. I think this is, you know, one of the big milestones, like I said, of the project is shifting this flow. And we're looking forward to getting it done. So happy to take any questions if anybody has any.
Yes, Helen has a question.
Yes.
So I think I know the answer to this, but it would be a good place to ask it and have it answered, because maybe I don't. If at some point in the future, all the gates all the way across were to be removed or raised entirely, leaving a bridge with the framing intact, in other words, these frames that you see around where the gates are, would the structure be structurally sound enough? In other words,
yes,
because this has been discussed that sometime it may be possible and appropriate to have the whole thing just be a bridge.
Yeah. So, Carol, if you want to flip back one slide, I can answer that better with probably pictures involved. So in the picture on the right, you can see those five gate panels. Those, that's what we call the actual concrete structure with the gates themselves that are going to get affixed to those. And on the photo on the left, you can see them being installed. And those gate panels just slide into place. And I say just, they are 35,000 pounds of concrete. So there is some effort that's involved in putting them in and taking them out, but they are designed to be removed if and when that ever wants to happen. Now, there could be, if you wanted to open the river up. So I guess to answer your question, there's no structural bearing of the bridge itself on these gate panels. They don't create any structural, they only support themselves, really. So they can be removed. They're designed to be removed. And I don't anticipate that day happening soon, but it is, you know, sometime maybe in the future, under full restoration, that could be achieved and done.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Wes, very much.
You're welcome.
All right, moving on with a brief update on the Mill Creek Water Control Structure, which is a project that's being undertaken by the Park Service on property owned by the Park Service with funding from the Natural Resources Conservation Service. So at this stage, the project is more than halfway complete with an estimated completion in August of 2025. Currently, or in the past recent months, the water control portion of the infrastructure has been constructed. Currently, vertical H piles are being installed inside the cofferdam area. Other sheet pile is being installed currently through just about Christmas time. In concrete formwork in preparation for the footings of the actual water control structure are set to begin construction just after the first of the year. So, and as I think previously reported, a bypass pipe was initially installed, and that's allowing continuous migratory passage for fish and eels during the construction period. So great progress there. I don't know if there's any more either Jen or Jeff, you want to add to the progress of the structure at this point?
Not to the structure, nothing for me.
Okay, super. All right. Another update I just wanted to provide this afternoon is just to let the Executive Council and those listening know about some updated regulatory filings. Nothing, you know, of major significance, but important, of course, to keeping authorizations current. We do have a meeting of the Regulatory Oversight Group, which is a group formed by the secretaries, the State Energy and Environmental Affairs Secretary's Certificate of MEPA Compliance for the project. That was back in 2016. That certificate created a regulatory oversight group that consists of representatives from all of the local, county, state, and federal agencies that are reviewing the project. So it's a rather long list of agencies. There's also participation by the Wampanoag tribe. So that group meets essentially on an annual basis to get an update on the project and discuss any pressing issues that may have a bearing on permits. So the focus of the upcoming meeting is likely to include a review of the information that Wes just provided in terms of the latest stage of construction and the water control for the construction of the bridge project, as well as a briefing on the marsh demonstration pilot projects that we've previously discussed here that are attempts to examine different methods of elevating the marsh plain to enhance restoration potential. So that meeting is going to be a virtual meeting. It's posted on the town's website, so there is Zoom access information available to anyone who wishes to participate. Also, we anticipate filing with the Conservation Commission in the coming weeks some information related to a plan changes. So these are modifications to different aspects of plans for the project. We expect there would be information related to additional area of roads that will be paved. So these are areas between work zones where the roads will be elevated, as we discussed in the meeting in October. There'll be some paving sort of between those areas that was not represented on the plans that were filed with the commission and authorized as part of the order of conditions. This work will, you know, enhance the functioning of the roads and will not result in any additional resource area impacts under the jurisdiction of the commission. We also anticipate including some information related to changes of plans on the golf course for the mitigation work there, relocating the Hall Road that is intended to be the conduit for moving material from the club off the club's property for use on the low roads would be stored at the town pit. So that's a plan that's in development, and we expect to share that information with the Conservation Commission as well. If that plan moves forward, it actually would reduce resource area impacts. So there'd be fewer wetland impacts resulted from that relocated Hall route. And then we would also report some additional fill that will be needed to adjust for settling that's likely to occur on the club's property. Again, all within the same footprint, so no change in alteration of impacts, but still just keeping the commission apprised of modifications to plans based on new information that's been generated. So we expect to file that information with the Conservation Commission in early January. More than likely, there will be a meeting with the commission sometime in January or early February where they would, you know, review or discuss this information should they desire to do so. We also will be following that work with the Conservation Commission, filing with the Planning Board for scenic road bylaw review for the low road work. So the roads involved are considered scenic roads, the bylaw is concerned with modifications to trees or monuments or fences, stone fences and things of that sort that contribute to the character, the scenic character of the roadways. So we are going to be undertaking an assessment of any tree related impacts associated with the work and reviewing that with the Planning Board, also anticipated in early 2025. And then lastly, the marsh demonstration projects that we've spoken of previously, and I mentioned a few moments ago, those would be the subject of a notice of project change with the MEPA office, the Massachusetts Environmental Policy Act office. And following their review, we would anticipate additional permitting filings with Conservation Commission and also Department of Environmental Protection, but those are a little bit further down the road, and we'll be able to update you at your next meeting in March. We'll have more information on the timing of those filings. It's a little bit of regulatory work ahead of us there. So that concludes the project update. That's essentially the new information we wanted to share with you since your meeting just last, the end of October. If there aren't any further questions on the project update, I'd move right on to the next agenda item, which is kind of a briefing and discussion on archiving and data management. So let me just pause and see if executive council members have any further questions on the project update. All right, I'm not seeing any at this point. So let's move on. to the topic of archiving and data management. And this is certainly a large and important topic for the council's consideration and for all of us to consider. A huge amount of information has been generated through the various stages of conceiving and planning this project and will continue to be compiled as the project moves forward through implementation. And having a very well thought out, well planned infrastructure for organizing and managing that data and making it accessible to those who may need to access it for various purposes is an important undertaking and one that we're spending a fair amount of time discussing and planning at this stage. Of course, there is a lot of information that is already organized and accessible to those who may want to view it. There are documents that are available through the Park Service's website. There are documents that are in studies that are available through the U.S. Geological Service. There are documents available through the Friends of Herring River website and also on the town's website, permit documents and things of that sort. But they're all sort of, you know, in different places. There's some duplication, and certainly we want to do better in the future with our organization of this information. So we started a work group among the technical team members, our project partners, the town and the seashore, to think this through and also ensure that we're meeting any grant requirements for making information accessible to the public. And we started by just kind of listing what are key objectives of any sort of data management and archiving effort, which would be certainly, you know, to document the history of the project and make sure that the story of the project and how it evolved, the integrity of that story is maintained for future posterity. We also want to be able to demonstrate and document compliance with any regulatory requirements, with any funders' requirements. So having information that's readily accessible in a form that can be shared for that purpose is very important. It's also important to have this information in a form that is ready for informing decision-making. So for example, as the project proceeds, the Executive Council will be considering further stages of tide gate management policy. So having the information available to inform that decision-making and many other decisions will be an important objective of this program. Retaining institutional knowledge. So already there, over the course of a decade or more, there's been quite a bit of turnover in terms of some of the folks involved in the project, either at the agency level or at the town level. That obviously will continue as some of us move on. But you know, having that institutional knowledge for people to you know, have access to is an important objective. And of course, transparency, just having information available to people who may be interested in the project and learning more about it for any number of reasons. So those are some primary objectives that are sort of driving the thought process for this data management and archiving system. We also wanted to think about who might be among the parties that would utilize such a system. So certainly current and future, you know, team members, contractors, we have a number of different engineering companies, town and seashore employees, our funding partners are often looking for information for various purposes. There could be researchers who have nothing to do with the project, but maybe looking at similar projects or have similar research questions that are tied to issues that are integrated in the project. Other projects across the country that may want to learn from the various lessons and experience of the restoration project. And of course, members of the general public who just may have interest. So one of the first steps we're taking is to really take a close look and inventory the current data assets and where they are stored. So I mentioned previously that the Park Service, the NPS, National Park Service, has some information stored on its website. Friends of Herring River has a good deal of information stored on their website. U.S. Geological Survey has a lot of data that they've been collecting over many years and some reports and analysis of that data also available. and there are others, but as an important starting point, we want to make sure we have a good idea of all of the assets that we need to organize and what may be coming in the future. We also have been thinking a great deal about functionality. So some of the things that we think are important in this design of this system will be having sort of a central clearinghouse. It's probably not feasible that all information will be stored in one place, but hopefully there will be a place where people can go and fairly quickly and accessibly see where they need to go for other things. So even though information may not be stored in this one location, there will be quick links to other pertinent information that would be easy for people to access. We also need to have a clear, reasonable process for selecting what data gets stored and how it gets stored. So what's important to store, what's important to make accessible. There are reams and reams of data and lots of studies and plans. We have multiple iterations of engineering plans for each of the project elements. It's literally tons of data. So having a reasonable selection process for culling what's important to share and to have accessible is a primary focus. We also have lots of reports and analysis, and we have lots of data, which are really two different questions when you think about archiving. So the extent to which we want to have raw data available and who owns the data, who controls the data, lots of questions there that will have to be parsed. Certainly ease of access and having as close to real-time access as possible for some sorts of data and resources is something we're considering. And also we want to have this be a tool for the folks who will be involved in the ongoing management of the restoration project. So it is something that is, accessible and easy to use and will be used for that purpose to really inform the project as it moves forward. And then lastly, I guess I would note that we're wrestling with some physical capacity and resource issues. There are a number of different data management systems that exist. So we want to look at those and find one that we think is workable in this instance. It's not in an inconsiderable amount of resources. Some of these are expensive to construct or to populate, maintain. So we need to really have a clear idea of what the resources will be to both create this data management system, but also to maintain it. Because there's, it's like a website, you can spend a lot of time and resources creating a beautiful website, but if you don't keep it current, it really is not a very good investment. So we want to think through sort of the life cycle of this data management system so that we have a clear idea of its sustainability in the long term. So with that, a couple of next steps, and then I think we want to share a couple of examples of current thinking about this. We'll continue to inventory the assets. We're beginning to just think about the categories of assets that are important and how we would organize those. So these are a few of the categories that we're looking at presently, planning studies, technical studies, governance documents, plans and specifications, and lots of documentation related to permitting and compliance. And with that, Jeff, I know you have been focusing on this work within the Park Service at the seashore, and I wanted to invite you to maybe share the next couple of slides with some examples of that work.
Sure. Thanks, Carol. Like Carol said, there's a ton of information out there, and regardless of Herring River Project or anything, one of the mandates that the Park Service has, and I think a lot of federal agencies have, is barring any sensitivity to the data that would prevent it from being shared, we have a mandate to share any data that we collect or are contracting out, anything that's used, anything that's that government funding is used to produce. So to that end, the Park Service has a data store. It's called the NPS data store. It's a clearinghouse that is used to store any number of things, from reports and documents to data. So this is one of a goal of our program here is, again, regardless of Herring River Project or any other project we're working on, is eventually anything that we're working on, we would like to see those products be made available through this system. But it does provide us with a great tool to use for sharing documents related to Herring River. And this is by no means a solution that would, that satisfy all of the requirements that Carol talked about. I mean, there's still a lot of discussions going on. There's still a lot of things that we have to go over. This is just one of the ways that we're working on to meet our mandates internally. And it might be something that could be useful to serve the benefit, the whole project. But essentially what we can do, and this is a very high level discussion about it, but we can take reports and documents and data sets, and we can enter them into this system, providing a fair bit of background information to make them searchable and usable in the future, so that if someone pulls it up, they have enough background information to understand where the document was created, why it was done, that type of thing, who did it. We have a staff person working with us over the winter, and this is one of the things that he's working on, is to kind of go through a catalog of documents. So Tim Smith's done a great job of cataloging a lot of information related to the Herring River Project. But given the vast quantities of it, you know, dedicating the amount of time necessary to get it into a system like this, it takes a ton of time. So one of the things that we have this staff are working on over the winter is sort of taking a crack at that. And so he's been entering some things into this system. And once you get it in there, you can then organize it into bins, if you will. So like you can see that these bullets here are three bins that we just kind of came up with. Nothing, just sort of examples, nothing that says this is how we have to move forward, but sort of planning and compliance documents, science and publications and data, and then technical and engineering reports. And these are all specific to the Herring River Project. So we can create these bins and then add various documents that fit in these categories into these bins. And then we can make the links to those bins available to whoever wants them. And so Carol, if you go to the next slide. So here's an example of the bin that's for planning and compliance. You can see we haven't gotten terribly far. There's only four documents in here. I think we have some more since this snapshot was taken. But basically, if you click on that link above, you would then be given a whole list of documents or reports, whatever exists in that bin. And so this is sort of a way to organize information and share this through our website. I think there's another example here too, Carol, but I'm not sure if that. Yeah, here's another one on more of the technical and engineering reports. And this would, again, determining what goes in which bin is also somewhat subjective. So, you know, if we determine that things need to be rebinned, it's very easy to move things around or change the description of it or something like that. So this is just a couple of examples that we're using to sort of organize the information, and that might make it easier for us to share with others. We haven't posted these things publicly on our website yet, but I have shared the links with some folks to help them more easily access certain types of documents, because I think there's going to be an interest in a lot of this stuff. But again, this is sort of just one example of how we're thinking about approaching it on our end. And this would obviously need to fit into the larger data management approach that the project takes as a whole, though.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Jeff. So I think that's a pretty much an overview of our current thinking and current work on this topic. I know it was brought up at the last meeting as a topic of interest. So certainly welcome the council's, you know, thoughts or questions or input on this as we continue to flesh out the components of a possible system. Helen.
Yeah, Jennifer, Jeff, Tim, thank you so much. This is gorgeous. It's been going on for a long time, this project, and this hasn't happened. Better late than never. But time and again, I've tried to find dates of things, both in the town's database and otherwise, and have spent literally hours making calls, trying to figure out where it was, where it wasn't. And there are going to be people who aren't even alive yet that may want to look at this information. Mm-hmm. I'm particularly concerned with, and it might be a category to put on it, for future DPW, Town of Wellfleet DPW function. The operations, ongoing management operations, the technical, physical facts of the structure and how to use them and what it's made of, beyond the engineering, you know, plans. The technical team has discussed with our DPW director present, this is how that would happen. It's a very physical thing, and I am very concerned that the town of Wellfleet, which will be maintaining the bridge and, you know, the structure, will have new employees in 10 years, 15 years, and will not be able to, will have to invent the wheel. So I'm concerned about that. The other thing is, minutes are good, and Carol, thank you for your excellent minutes over the years that this has been going on. But I tried to find the recordings of these meetings, right, this morning. I'm pretty good at that. I'm pretty good at finding things in the jungle. And I could find nowhere the recordings of these meetings. And right now, you know, people are looking for a possible person to fill the new position, and they should be able to look at a recording, because in my experience, no matter how good minutes are, the recording really gives you the rationale very often for why something was decided. And it's very valuable. You know, it isn't just the end result and a note that there was discussion and maybe one or two ideas brought up. That's all open meeting law, compliant minutes, it's fine. But time and again, I've tried to understand why a decision was made, and I only fully understood it when I saw the recording. So I guess the question is, where are those recordings, and why are they not, like in what I found this morning, which was not easy to find on the town website? Thank you.
Thanks, Helen. And just a quick response to a couple of your points. So let me start with the recordings first. You're right, they're not accessible. They exist, and we'll find a way to make those more accessible and easy to find for folks. I just want to comment too on the bridge operations and management, because there has been a lot of discussion about that of late. In fact, just this afternoon at the progress meeting with the contractor, because one of their contractual requirements is to generate that information. But we're sort of thinking above and beyond in terms of even creating some video content and having information in a variety of different formats. So that, you know, for example, you know, Wes spoke to the raising of those gate panels, you know, that might happen in 10, 20 years. So having information about how that might occur, even some video content about how that might occur, and having that available in the record for future DPW personnel is top of mind right now. So I think everyone acknowledges and recognizes that this isn't your average bridge, and you know, going a little bit above and beyond in terms of pulling together those materials now will be hugely beneficial in years ahead. Wes, I don't know if there's any more you would want to add on that.
I would just echo your point that, you know, that your concerns, Helen, are well taken, and we're really working hard to address them, at least in terms of the bridge right now. We're trying to suss out all the hurdles that somebody might come across, understanding that it might be, you know, none of the people that are currently working on this project having to deal with it. So yeah, it's a really good concern of yours, and I know that we are, as a project team, trying to address them.
Thanks, Wes. Jennifer?
I endorse the project. I think, of course, it's valuable. You know, the vast majority of what we do is public, and I assume all of this is public facing. The only two, really the only one caution I just wanted to raise is I hear, Helen, your concern about passing on institutional knowledge. As I think many folks know, I've worked in law enforcement and security for about 30 years. Dam safety and bridge safety tends to be records that we don't want to be 100% public facing around. And so I do think as we talk about how much of the design, how much of the operations we want to make truly 100% public versus things that are important to capture, but would be for those folks that had a sort of a need to know. Again, this is the town's portion of the project, not ours, but I just, for the good of the order, I feel the need to just remind us that we want to probably put a little bit of security lens on that kind of information as we release things to the public. Thank you.
Helen, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Jennifer. Jennifer, yes, I get it. But, you know, as with, let's say, a library that restricts access, you know, to the point where you have to get permission to see certain archival material, that makes sense. But if, say, the DPW director in 10 years or 20 years needs to look at it, that would be something that should be accessible, right? It isn't.
No, agreed. I just, the public component.
No,
I just want
the
to
public,
caution.
I get it, without censorship. But, you know, the other thing is, this is an archive that, in a sense, belongs to this council, this intergovernmental committee, if you want to call it that, group. And the park has a bunch, the town has a bunch, the Friends who have been delegated by the town but really work for the project has a bunch. And I think that, like, the town and the park should be aware of the fact that we're sort of co-parenting, you know, we're co-parenting the project, the estuary, and that this material should be managed properly and appropriately, but that it really belongs to this group in a way. That's my concept of it, which doesn't mean that we can just do what we want with it if we're appointees of the town or members of the Park Service. You know, we can't, we have to respect the group's needs and be discreet in relation to them. Thank you.
Thank you, Helen. Any further comment or discussion? Jeff?
Sorry, I couldn't find my hand. I guess I would, the one thing I would just add is that the system, the examples that I showed here are definitely, it definitely represents an imperfect system for the project as a whole, because it's a system that the Park Service employees have easy access to. So the public can get in there and see everything that's public record, but they can't edit anything. And similarly, to allow project partners to get in who aren't members of the Park Service to have them edit, it's a very complicated process and it's somewhat unwieldy. So this would only, you know, this wouldn't necessarily be the solution that would be usable for every party. And like the example you gave, Helen, of the operating component manuals or things like that to go with the bridge or the dam, that would, since that's a town structure, they would really be the stewards of that. The town would be the stewards of that. And it probably, this system may not be the best place to put that. So there, like, this goes back to, you know, how Carol was explaining the complexity of this issue. And I think you touched on it too, with all the parties involved. So yeah, there's going to be a lot of moving pieces, and there will likely have to be multiple components to this to really satisfy the needs of the project.
So, I mean, even today's discussion has highlighted even newer nuances to all of this. So I appreciate the input. And, you know, this is a topic that we will be talking about in the future. We are just getting underway in the development of this architecture, and we'll be back in touch with further thoughts about it, and certainly to get your input on how we move this forward. So, all right. Thank you very much. And thank you, Jeff, for sharing that great work that you're doing within the park structure. All right, the next agenda item is Griffin Island Access. So this item was brought up during the public comment section of your last meeting. It was brought up by Mr. Yeston, who's here this afternoon. And so you had requested that it be added to the agenda for your next meeting. I'll just take a moment to share some basic information and then turn it over to executive council members who may have further comment on this, just to orient everyone to kind of the area in question, Duck Harbor Road, in relation to the project. So what we understand in talking with our partners at the seashore and the town is that the fee ownership of Duck Harbor Road, which essentially runs from Chequesset Neck Road along the river to Duck Harbor Road and to Duck Harbor Beach, the fee ownership is owned by the park, and there is also a 30-foot easement for a public way that is the town's. So both parties have some interest here. Our understanding is further that neither the town nor the park actively maintains the road. And beyond the point where the High Toss Road causeway occurs, there's no through access. So it's not a straight shot, although, as has been pointed out, a portion of the road is passable up to that point at the High Toss Road causeway. There are no residences fronting on the road, so it is not serving as a primary access to residences, although obviously to some as a secondary access. And with respect to the project, the only project element that utilizes a portion of Duck Harbor Road is this is a snippet from the water access component of the bridge project. So there's a parking area that has about six or eight spaces here. So this is Chequesset Neck Road here. The bridge would be to your right. So this is a parking area that will be ADA accessible. There'll be a walkway down to a portage area by the water and at the base of the bridge. So that is right at the sort of the entrance of Duck Harbor Road, where it intersects with Chequesset Neck Road. There isn't any other work in project plans that are currently either permitted or funded on Duck Harbor Road. I noted the High Toss Road causeway, so where presently one might traverse from Chequesset Neck Road up Duck Harbor Road and then cross over the causeway. The causeway will be removed as part of the project to facilitate restoration of Upper Herring River. So that is a permitted and funded project element. So just to refresh everyone on that as well. And we did take a look at what the modeling information indicates in terms of tidal impacts to Duck Harbor Road. And at the end of phase one, areas which might be considered the lowest road segments along Duck Harbor Road, which would be, you know, up to 4 feet in elevation, NADD 88, which is the baseline elevation metric, there would be some overtopping at certain levels of the tide, at certain tidal cycles that we anticipate would be 6 to 8 days out of the year. There might be these tidal cycles that would cause this sort of overtopping of up to a half a foot of water that would be expected to recede fairly quickly because of course, with the gates and the new bridge structure, the drainage out of the system will be that much quicker. So there would be some impact at the end of phase one. At full tidal restoration, that impact would be a bit greater in terms of the duration or frequency as much as it might be the amount of water that would be on the road at any given time during those tidal cycles that again might occur 6 to 8 days a month and would be expected to recede as tides change. So we're talking about high tide conditions that would recede over the course of a few hours during the tidal cycle. So just to be clear about that potential as we can assess it based on the model we have currently, that's what it shows. So we just wanted to provide that, you know, essential kind of factual information that we have available today about the road and its relationship to the project. And I just want to invite the council members who were interested in having this on the agenda to add any more to your thoughts about this or any questions you may have. Helen?
Yeah. So I read carefully Mr. Yeston's letter, considering other options. And Carol, thank you for clarifying the decisions that were made and much discussed in many meetings about what would happen if you left the berm that goes across the marsh leading to the High Toss Bridge or the High Toss Bridge and the culvert and so forth. In other words, it would really impede the restoration. And that was settled a long time ago with a lot of public discussion, including a town meeting. So I reviewed all that after hearing from Mr. Yeston. And the problem, the way to get off that Griffin Island and that whole body of land is real if there's a fire. But if I was there, living there, I would think the key thing would be to make sure the fire department guarantees that that way would not be in any way obstructed, no matter how much mutual aid from other towns showed up. Because that, if I understood correctly from Mr. Yeston, that is what happened. People have to be able to leave, but that wide road, which is paved, is more of a fire break than any, let's say, 30 feet up from the existing river and the existing Duck Harbor Road would be, which would be at best 8 feet wide and have to be maintained. And it would be surrounded by trees. And I understand that all those people out there and their structures also need protection, you know, need to be able to leave, not just sort of run to the beach and stand on the beach while the whole, you know, rise of land that goes far north there is burned in one swell swoop. And this happens now, and we know it. So it's a real concern. But I would think the key thing would be to have the equipment that fire department and any other fire departments bring to the scene, leave a way for people to use that road, that there's always going to be somebody up there who would be able to make sure that nothing got parked blocking that road, whether or not there's another access. I have a question through you, Carol. Let's say you're the chair here for Mr. Yeston. Would that be okay? Because it's key to what's being discussed. Would that be okay?
Is the question, well, it's sure, if you wish to ask a question of Mr. Yeston, that's your prerogative, sure.
Yeah, so is he unmuted?
I'm here.
Are you there? Can you hear me?
Yeah, hi.
So the idea of having an alternate route off, given that no bridge over, you know, the marsh is going to happen because of needing to have that completely open for tidal flow. Let's say there was this, you know, the alternate road running up the hill from the river that would go along the east side of Griffin Island that would have to be cleared by the park. They'd have to get permission for it. This is all very, you know, not sure that that could even happen. But would it be accessed? Would you be willing to grant an easement through your property for anybody to use that to access it? I mean, I'm not saying it makes sense or not, but was that part of the plan? It wouldn't just, you know, if that happened, it would be a public way, really, or yeah, it would be a public way for people on the island.
It's already a public way, Helen.
Yeah.
No, yes. No. This would be a new way above what exists now, because that's going to be underwater, Duck Harbor Road. I know that Duck Harbor Road is public, but we're talking about, if you looked at the map that came with Mr. Yeson's material, it would be about 30 feet up the hill, right?
Oh, if a new road was cut.
Yeah.
And that would be on Park Service property. That's not on his property.
That's correct. But it would be accessed from the road that goes to Duck Harbor.
That's also entirely within the park.
Yes, but if the easement ran through your property, where there's already a driveway,
So what you're referring to is named Yeston Way, but it is entirely within the boundaries of the park at the moment.
Yes, but isn't it your private driveway?
No.
So that road existed and is owned by the park, and you have no control over it.
I have deeded rights to use it, but I do not.
Okay. So it would go past your house along that way, which you're saying could be used as, you know, there'd be public access. And then it would cut back towards the dike, the bridge, whatever we're going to call it in the future. You know, it would take a right-hand turn and go to the right. And it's about, I believe I asked you this, it's about 2,000 feet, correct? Cut through the woods up the hill from the existing Duck Harbor Road. So I'm just putting that out there. And we've established that it's already a way that could be used by the public. If it's a, you know. Okay, thank you. That's all I wanted to clarify. So considering that as an option, I'm done. I've clarified what access to that from Griffin Island Road would consist of. And of course, the question is, would it make any sense, given that it would probably be more hazardous because there's so many trees around it? I mean, I've thought about this carefully, and I wish others would weigh in on it if they have any thoughts. Thank you.
I think Jennifer, you put your hand up.
I guess, Carol, I am not. I have lots of thoughts, but my question really was, I'm not totally clear about why it's on the agenda today and what we're being asked to decide or consider. I've met with Mr. Yeston. I've looked at this quite a bit. I've driven all of the roads that we're talking about just within the last week. So I'm really prepared to talk about it, but it's not clear to me what the question in front of the executive council is.
Well, the question wasn't clearly articulated other than to allow there to be a discussion about this question of alternative access off of Griffin Island for those properties. And, you know, from the project's perspective, we haven't had an opportunity to just share the basic information that we outlined before in terms of, you know, how this project, you know, utilizes or doesn't utilize Duck Harbor Road and what the implications are for that particular area. So one thing we wanted to do is just put that out there on the table so everyone understands. Mm-hmm. And then to the extent, I mean, you know, it is not, any further work on Duck Harbor Road is not currently in the project. So there's nothing more we can add as the project team to the discussion. And I think if there are other public safety concerns or questions, they may not be for this group to discuss. They may be broader town issues, but I, you know, certainly we do have some town officials here. If they wish to weigh in, I don't want to put anyone on the spot, but I mean, from the project's perspective, we just wanted to lay out that basic information since it's come up in a number of, you know, project related meetings.
Okay. And Helen, do you want to clarify that or should I go ahead with my?
No, Carol just did. Thank you. Carol just did an excellent job explaining why I think this is a good thing for this group, our group, right? The intergovernmental group, to have knowledge of and to look at. It isn't a decision, the only bearing the project has on a decision about this, which would be up to the park entirely. It's a land use decision, which would happen independently of the project, is that it's a fact that the project is going to inundate Duck Harbor Road, which exists and certain vehicles can use it. I can't really do it with my car, but other people have, you know, other kinds of vehicles. So it's good to bring it into the open in a public meeting. And also, we need to clarify this kind of thing going forward. It shouldn't just happen like in private meetings one-on-one, because things like this come up in different ways as it is in different parts of the project, like what happens with the Miller Fredrickson issue there is not the same, but not unrelated. Thank you. Sorry, Jennifer, thank you for letting me speak.
Mm-hmm. With those two lenses, I'm just trying to, I guess for this conversation, I am not advocating or supportive of the project taking on raising that road segment as an addition to the project. I've driven them. Mr. Yeston and I had a good conversation and we looked at maps. I agree that they are all currently passable with a high clearance vehicle. At least the segment from Chequesic Neck Bridge to High Toss. I appreciate that the concerns around fire are very sincere. What I struggle with is there are hundreds of examples within the seashore and within Wellfleet of places that only have one point of egress. Where park headquarters is, has one point of egress. You know, we have lots and lots of property owners in the ponds that have really unimproved roads that are their only way out. And where we have a paved road and a what will be a very nice bridge in here in this place, I have a very difficult time prioritizing this as the greatest need as I look across my area of responsibility, my portfolio. So for the purposes of the Herring River Restoration Project, I don't advocate or endorse adding this as another element. And I think that's what the question before the executive council is today. And I don't see anybody from the town on, so I won't speak for the town, but I did check with my colleagues in the town and they did not share concerns with me that would have changed my opinion.
Thank you, Jennifer. Jeff?
Yeah, I think it's important to touch on the last couple bullet points on your slide, Carol, is that the amount that this road will be affected by tidal inundation under phase one, which is the only phase that's permitted, it's going to be extremely limited. There won't be a lot of flooding at all. And it would only flood in extreme circumstances. And even under the full project, phase two included, with all the tide gates open and storm of record type conditions, yes, there would be portions of that road that would flood, but it would not stay inundated for very long. Depending on conditions at the time, it might vary. But so I just think it would be important to point that out, that it's not like this road will not be, once these tide gates start opening, it's not like this road is going to flood all the time. It will flood very, very infrequently in the first phase of the project. So I just want to, and also once it's flooded, it's not going to be flooded a great deal. So any vehicle that's capable of driving it now, given the conditions, And like Jennifer said, it would have to be a high clearance vehicle would be able to drive through the limited amount of water on the road in those conditions anyway. So that's just something I think we should just make clear that it's not like the first phase of this project or even part the second phase of this project is going to make this road completely impassable all the time.
This is not a public comment session, but if the members wish to hear from Mr. Yeston, he's interested in making a comment.
I yield to Mr. Yeston.
I appreciate that. I just wanted to touch on just that last point because I think it's fair, but you know, the hypersaturation of the soil is going to make this road impassable much larger than just the time period in which there's actually water on the road, right? So it's going to create muddy conditions. It's going to bring debris into the right of way. I don't totally feel confident that just because there's only a limited amount of time that this road's going to be inundated with water, that it's going to be entirely passable throughout, you know. And as previously stated, there's no one responsible for maintaining this road. It's maintained by volunteers. There's a few groups. You know, and to speak to, you know, the superintendent's point, and I appreciate that they need to prioritize, right? You know, lay limited resources. I don't think it's wise, and I personally don't think it's responsible to create a more unsafe situation. We have 2 points of egress. I think if you speak to any public safety expert, they would say 2 points of egress is safer than one. It's why we have to have 2 points of egress in a home, right? You can't build a brand new home with only one door. You just can't. I don't believe the town should take on the responsibility and liability of removing egress. I think you're diminishing the safety of both the residents and visitors. You know, I won't waste the time of this committee by reading my letter, but I do hope that everyone read it, and I hope that it's published so everyone else can read it. Responding to a fire out in Griffin Island requires very, very large reservoirs of water. It spans the entire roadway. You cannot pass it. I appreciate that the present stance of this council seems to be that they don't want to do anything. I will continue to try to find other forums in which to change this council's mind. I think that we have an opportunity here where we have some very eager project funders, and I would hope that this council reconsiders their position and tries to find a solution. You know, there's not a lot of us out there, but there's a lot of visitors. When something goes wrong, it goes really, really wrong. I don't know why this council will willfully choose to make a more unsafe environment. Thank you.
All right. Any further comment from executive council members on this matter? All right. Thank you all. Then we can move on to the next agenda item, which is the hearing over stakeholder group and appointments to the group, as was announced at the last executive council meeting. A long-term member of the stakeholder group, Laura Runkle, had passed away, unfortunately, and so representation of the Upper Poldike Creek Subbasin, which she ably represented for many years, is open. There are also several members of the stakeholders group that have terms expiring at the end of March of 2025. So there's a potential to reappoint those members. Some of them have indicated their interest to continue. And then a question raised about Griffin Island neighborhood. I see that Bill Bowenga, the chair of the stakeholder group, is here. And Bill, I would invite you to maybe speak a little more to these three items, if you wish.
Hey, thanks, Carol. I assume that you can hear me now?
Yes.
Great, thank you. The first part, I think, is about replacing Laura Runkle, who's passed away. And I believe that Helen has had some discussions with a gentleman I talked with as well, Ira Wood,
and Mr. Wood is here today.
And he's here today as well. Yeah. So maybe Helen wants to introduce him as a member of the committee. And it's not my job to be doing the denominations, but I'm glad to introduce him. He seems like a really fine guy, and I'm sure that he'd be a fabulous addition to the team. Helen, do you have some comments?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm qualified, except I've known Ira Wood for a long time. I served on the select board with him. He's familiar with the project. He serves on the FinCom, which is not a conflict, but would be a benefit. And, you know, he's a good guy. I mean, I would, first of all, I'd like to have somebody to fill Laura's position. And Ira lives on land that does abut the upper Poldike Marsh. And I'm going to, if after other people have said something, I'm going to ask for any appointment we do like this to be a vote. In other words, for this, I'm going to move that we vote on this, and then, you know, that's the way it goes with us, and then we can vote on it if we want to. Thank you.
Thanks, Helen. Jennifer?
I just had a question, Carol. I was trying to look at maps, and I reviewed the standing membership as articulated in the stakeholder group charter, mm-hmm. or the what organization we represented. And I don't understand the geography well enough to understand where Griffin Island would fit in. And before we voted, I just wanted to understand how the Griffin Island neighborhood isn't represented by the three neighborhood people already. And maybe, I don't know if we look, you know, I've got the map pulled up from the Herring River Friends group, but that was my only question before we vote another person in, would any of those other seats be appropriate for Griffin Island? And so if someone could just educate me about that, please.
Sure. The appointment to replace Laura Runkle would be that I think Mr. Wood has expressed interest in that position. That's an existing position in Upper Poldike Creek. So that is an actual sub basin that has a structure that will be manipulated during tidal restoration. So I think the thinking around the Upper Poldike Creek sub basin is that, you know, those properties will in a subsequent, you know, beyond phase one, have a potential mitigation requirements and things like that. So that was very
okay. And I'm seeing that on the map. Yeah. That's the upstream from our Mill Creek
and the other
water control structures.
Yes. The other expiring terms are existing user groups that are identified in the charge. And then the Griffin Island neighborhood question is really just for discussion. There's no proposal on the table or request at the moment. I mean, it's just that it was raised again and it was noted. I think it came up at the stakeholders group meeting that was held a couple of weeks ago, and it was requested that be, brought forward for your discussion and consideration, but no expectation of any particular action by the stakeholder group.
Got you. And I'm seeing the bounds of Upper Bound Brook mm-hmm. and Mill Creek on the map. And so I recognize that those, though that representative would not share responsibility for the Griffin Island area. Thank you.
Okay.
If I may?
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jennifer, it's nowhere near Griffin. It's nowhere near Bound Brook. It's the marsh that goes all the way to Route 6 with Moby Dick.
And yeah, I found it, Helen. Thank you. I found it on the, finally found it okay. on the website. I couldn't quite find it before, but
it's nowhere near Mill Creek.
Got it.
Thank you. Sorry. Does Mr. Wood wish to say anything? I think it would be respectful to ask him at least.
I'm not on the FinCom, Helen. I quit. So.
Oh.
I am on the radio, however, weekly. So if you don't want a radio person, I'm not your man.
You have served on so many things for so many years that we would be lucky to have you on the stakeholder group.
Thank you.
So I think we can take these one at a time. And if there is, Helen, you expressed interest in a vote. So that would require a motion and a second. And it actually would require first a motion and a second to agree to vote on the matter.
Yes.
For your operating procedures. So if a matter is to be voted on by the Executive Council, that has to first be moved and seconded and voted upon, and then the motion can be made and voted upon. So does anyone wish to make that motion?
I move that we vote on the appointment to fill Laura's position on the Upper Poldike Creek Subbasin as a Upper Poldike Creek Subbasin representative.
All right, so that's a motion to vote on that matter. Is there a second to that motion?
Jeff, Jen?
Jeff just seconded the motion. Okay, so we have a motion and a second. So this is just to agreeing to vote on the matter as opposed to appointing by consensus. So all in favor of the motion?
Helen, aye.
Jen,
aye.
And Jeff, aye. Okay, so the motion carries and there will be a vote on the appointment. So the next step would be a motion to appoint.
I move that we appoint Ira Wood to the Upper Poldike Creek Subbasin as the Upper Poldike Creek Subbasin representative to the stakeholders group.
Helen, do you want to indicate a term? We have 1 year and 2 year terms.
For 2 years, for a 2 year term. And he can leave anytime he wants.
Thank you.
All right, so I would say that we now are on a March 31 cycle, so this would be March 31 of 2027. So that would be the term. Okay, so is there a second to the motion?
I'll second.
Thank you, Jen. Any further discussion on the motion? All in favor?
Helen, aye.
Jeff, aye.
Jen, aye.
Okay, that motion carries unanimously. So welcome, Mr. Wood. Thank you for joining the stakeholders group. Bill, I believe you have reached out to a couple of members whose terms are going to be expiring at the end of March to determine their interest in continuing to serve. Is that correct?
That is correct. First of all, welcome aboard, Ira. Glad to have you. We have a lot of really highly qualified people, and it's a very interesting group. So it's nice to be able to draw upon everybody's experience, and yours will add to the mix. I have reached out to a number of the people, and I can tell you the two people who have committed to renewing so far would be Fred Gaechter. I'm not very good at pronouncing his name, and Jordan Mora. She also has requested to renew, and I would recommend that we do it for 2 years so that there's an overlap with some of the other people, because a year from now, you know, the others will be coming due. So
yes,
we're probably better off doing it for 2 years. Melissa Lowe has suggested that perhaps it would be a good idea for Mass Audubon to have another representative replace her. So she's looking into that. And she gets some information back to me or to you, Carol, we can forward that to the committee as well. I don't believe that I've heard from Barbara Carey. I could be wrong. I, you know, may have misplaced the email if I got it. But that's where things stand with the four people who are up for renewal.
Thank you, Bill. So it would be possible, for example, I mean, in their terms won't expire till the end of March, and it's likely this group will meet in March, but just to be double safe, we would vote them today. So those two other appointments we could address at the March meeting, if it's the Executive Council's pleasure. I would also, one thing that we noted in reviewing all of the different memberships and terms and appointments is that Rebecca Taylor, who had been appointed to represent the Shellfish Advisory Board, when she was appointed, which was, I think was just last spring or I think it was within the last 6 months,
it was recent.
A term was not specified. So perhaps in making these reappointments for Fred Gechter and Jordan Mora to March 31, 2027, which I think is potentially a motion. There could also be a motion to clarify the term for Rebecca's appointment as representing the Shellfish Advisory Board. Of course, anyone can resign if they don't want to serve out their full term. It's no one's locked in, but it's just good to have that clarity for all concerned. So that would be one suggestion we could add to that list.
Good idea. Here's another suggestion. Currently, we're without a vice chairman for the stakeholders group. And I think it's always a good idea to have a contingency plan and a little assistance if necessary. So we might want to consider who would be a suitable vice chair for the stakeholders group as well.
So we could add that to the March agenda as well. I believe that is the Executive Council's role to appoint the chair and vice chair. So thank you, Bill, for noting that. We can add that to the March agenda. Jen?
Carol, I've been looking at the membership from the stakeholder group charter and the updated membership based on the meeting notes. The crosswalking is a little confusing to me. Would it be possible for the March meeting to sort of have a slate of candidates that we could just see or a document or something that just has, here's all the people we're voting on. I think it would make it a little more straightforward for me to follow along rather than just trying to quickly take notes on everybody's names. I have nothing I've heard that I'm objecting to. I think it would streamline it if we could have a slate of candidates to consider ahead so we can have that in front of us.
Absolutely. Good point. Thank you. All right. So at this point, I would invite a motion then to reappoint Fred Gechter and Jordan Mora to March 31, 2027. Fred, just to confirm, represents the Truro Conservation Trust and Jordan Association to Preserve Cape Cod, and to add clarity to Rebecca Taylor's term as the representative of the Shellfish Advisory Board to March 31, 2027 as well. So Helen.
Don't we have to move to vote on it?
Okay, so the motion to vote was only to appoint the one. You're correct.
I move that we vote on what Carol just said.
All right.
I second.
All right, that's moved and seconded. And any further discussion on the decision to vote on these appointments? If not, please signify by saying aye.
Hello. Aye.
Okay, so that's a unanimous vote. You have agreement to vote on the appointments to extend the terms. So now we would need a motion on the terms themselves for those three members.
I so move.
Thank you very much, Jen. Is there a second? Thank you.
One second.
Okay, and we have a motion and a second. If there's no further discussion, please signify your assent by saying aye or any opposed?
Aye.
Aye.
Helen, aye.
Jeff? Is that not shaking his head?
Oh, sorry. Yes.
All right, great. So that's a unanimous vote. So I don't even need to ask for any opposed or abstentions.
May I just say one thing about this? When I was helping with the drafting of MOU-4, I thought this was a silly step. Thank you. In other words, I think that we should have just had normal voting after discussion and not this thing of having to vote to vote. I tried. Thank you. Sorry.
And if if the council wishes to have further discussion, that's fine. But the alternative would be to, at your March meeting, perhaps following up on Jen's suggestion, bringing a map to identify the different areas represented geographically, that might put you in a better position to evaluate whether any further representation is needed. But I leave it to you. That's one approach. We could provide that information for your March meeting, or unless you want to have further discussion on the Griffin Island neighborhood representation today.
Yeah, I think it'd be helpful to have more of a comprehensive look at the existing representation and before we make any decisions about new seats.
I agree with Jeff, and I would also be very willing to hear from whoever advanced this recommendation about why they feel they're not represented in the current configuration as part of that conversation.
Okay, very good. Helen?
Yeah, sorry about this. I'm sitting here with MOU 4, and I don't see anywhere that it says that the stakeholder group can't appoint their own vice chair, which is normal. We don't have to, in my opinion, rereading the MOU 4, which I'm pretty familiar with, I don't see that we have to do that. We have to appoint, we have to appoint it, and they get to choose who's going to be chair, and they get to choose who's going to be vice chair.
I think it may be in the stakeholder group charge that was actually approved by
the the charge. Okay, yeah. Sorry to take the time. Sorry. No,
but we can, we can look at that as well. So we've agreed on the following. So the appointments have been made, and we've agreed to have a discussion about representation, including Griffin Island neighborhood. And also we can talk about vice chair, selection of a vice chair. And we can just, review the charge and any other topics within it that the executive council wishes to discuss at that time. Okay. All right. Bill, anything more you would like to share?
Not regarding this. I do have some questions on some previously discussed things, data archiving and so forth, but I can wait till the public comments on that.
Public comment. Okay, super. And I just want to thank Bill publicly for his leadership, which has been amazing over the years. Thank you, Bill. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. It was requested that we share with the Executive Council any correspondence that may come in between your meetings as a regular matter. So we did share with you the only real correspondence from the community that came in was the package from Mr. Yeston, which was shared with the Executive Council. And we also just brought to your attention submissions to the Select Board for various matters that had gone before the Select Board since your last meeting, which primarily had to do with the road widening easements and layout matters, as well as some reallocation of grant funds, all of which had been reviewed and approved by the Select Board in recent meetings. Just to keep the Executive Council up to speed on those kinds of matters. We didn't have any other significant correspondence to share with you, but we will keep in mind any matters that we think should, would be of interest and could be shared with you, and make sure that those are included in your packet in advance of meetings. All right, and with that, it would be time for any member announcements that you wish to make. If there are any. All right, hearing any announcements?
An announcement just that we do have this open position on this group, and that we should consider, and do outreach for people to formally apply to the Wellfleet Select Board to be appointed to it or not, and to think about who has depth of knowledge and long-term connection to it, because it's such an ongoing project. you know, to beat the bushes and to get applicants so the select board can, you know, choose. Anyway, Sheila Lyons, who's on the select board, has very, you know, generously offered to do this. But it's a, you know, big deal position. So the normal process is that you put the word out there. I announced it at the beginning of the last select board meeting and wait for applicants and then, you know, vote to appoint somebody. Janet and I are still on it. So we need to fill that position. Thank you.
Any other member announcements? All right. Bless you, Jen. All right. Okay, that brings us then to public comment. And Bill, how about you go first?
Thank you. Yeah, the question that I had is mostly for Jeff, I think. And it has to do with the data archiving. And I assume that this is the case, but I just wanted to make sure that we're getting a baseline for how much vegetation is going to be contributing to methane sequestration and or carbon sequestration, as the case may be. I'm not the biologist to consider these things, but it strikes me that if at some point there's a financial implication as to how much methane is being sequestered by way of this restoration, we need to have a baseline of data. So,
a good question. There have been studies, and there are ongoing studies, and there will be additional studies that have documented the exchange of greenhouse gases, or any gases actually, between the atmosphere and vegetation, whether it's invasive Phragmites or salt marsh plants such as Spartina. So there's the exchange of gases, whether it's through the soil, water, or atmosphere, have been documented. And there will be additional studies going on as the restoration continues to further document how different restoration approaches might help enhance greenhouse gas capture. And I think it sounded like you were kind of touching on the fact that there is a carbon market out there, and to what extent the project could be a contribute to that or benefit from that. And that's a good question. There was a report done a number of years ago. Carol, I can't remember the group that did the report, but I guess it doesn't matter. But anyway, it focused on just that. And I think one of the things that has not been ironed out yet is, since most of the area being restored falls within the boundary of the National Seashore, to what extent the federal government or a federal agency can be a party to set something like that. And from my understanding, that is not something that has been really ironed out or clarified at all yet. So I think a lot of people are interested in finding that out, because to your point, if once the carbon markets kind of get if and when they get more momentum, I think it would be an interesting thing to look at.
Yeah, and I think as a second part to that question, what else would be interesting would be the idea of discussing if there is a carbon market, and if we are contributing to that carbon market, and if there's a financial implication to that, how that potential revenue might be shared. It's a better topic undertaken before there's money on the table, when things are less emotional, let's say. Mm-hmm. So you might want to consider that amongst yourselves, or, you know, bring it to the attention of the wider public here in town.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you, Bill. Any other public comment?
Carol, can you hear me? This is Gail.
Yes, Gail. Hi.
I didn't see a way to put my hand up. So I have two small things. One pertains to the discussion about the documenting history. Mm-hmm. Years ago, I use some videotapes that had been made of select board meetings to review discussions by Don Palladino and Steve Spear and the select board at the time that were important discussions. For instance, the discussion to eliminate the end of High Toss Road, the 30 feet at the end, or is it 30 feet or probably more now? Those discs, those DVDs were held at the library. I'm not sure that's still being done, and they would be good for you to know about them and perhaps access them mm-hmm. and preserve them.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is, Carol, you mentioned that there was a 30-foot easement owned by the town on the Duck Harbor Road. Can you say a little bit about that easement, describe it, where it begins and where it ends, and when it was granted, and if it still is in existence, actually?
I do not have that information at my fingertips, Gail. Okay. And I think I actually got that information through research that folks at the Park Service had done. Is that correct, Jen and Jeff?
I'll take it, Jeff. You know, I've been looking at, after meeting with Mr. Yeston, I did pull a lot of our park records. And yes, the park records indicate that it's a public way, both Duck Harbor and Yeston Way on the map. So none of that secret. So I'd be happy to share it like at the next meeting, but I don't have maps at my fingertips that I could pull up right this minute. But I can confirm that both of those roads are still reflected in the deeds that we have seen, that we have as public ways.
I think, thank you. One of the reasons that I'm asking is that I wondered if it was an old easement that that was interfered with when the decision was made to eliminate the end of High Toss Road. And it got me thinking, and I just wanted to know a little bit more about it. But thank you.
Thank you, Gail. Any other public comment?
Hi, Al Kraft.
Hey, Al.
Hi. I believe that a few months ago, there was a discussion that the Woods Hole group was going to be providing some data maybe in the first quarter of 2025, some new data. Is that, do I remember that correctly?
I believe what we discussed is that modeling would be getting underway. So I do not think they will have results to share in the first quarter, but the modeling activity would be getting underway.
Okay. So my only comment is that when those results are available, it could go onto your agenda.
When we have modeling results to share, for sure.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Other comment? All right. Not seeing any other further comment. Then the final item for the Executive Council this afternoon is just scheduling for 2025. So if we were to continue your traditional scheduling approach, what we've been doing is scheduling quarterly meetings, one in sort of the middle of March, one in the middle of June, one in the middle of September, and then middle of December. Historically, when issues have come up that have required more prompt or timely action, additional meetings have been scheduled, and they certainly can be with proper posting notice. So it's not that you're restricted only to the four meetings, but it puts the four meetings on your calendar so that, you know, it's all set and good to go. I did circulate on the agenda some optional dates, but I want to amend the March date because I believe that already doesn't work for some, and suggest the meetings would continue to be Thursdays at 3 p.m., via Zoom, unless you choose otherwise. And the suggested meeting dates would be March 13th, June 12th, September 18th, and December 18th.
I would like March 13th.
March 13th, as would work for you. How about the other, would the other dates work as well? June 12th, September 18th, and December 18th. So we've usually kind of booked out the year in advance, just to get it on everyone's calendar. Jen?
Yeah, I can support all four of those dates, Carol, with the adjustment to the March 13.
Excellent. Thank you. And Jeff?
Yep, looks good to me.
Okay. Helen? Those
dates? Yeah, you know, and I would have been open to all four of those dates too, but sooner rather than better, because these trips to the oasis of information from the desert of non-comprehension for the, you know, HREC is good. I know the park keeps up with it, but, you know, this kind of reporting that happens here is, I think, good to keep at least quarterly. Thank you.
All right, great. So we'll go ahead with those dates, and I will send out invitations so you can get those on your calendars. And of course, they'll be posted in advance. And we have, as a practice, been making the materials available to the stakeholder group members as well, so that they're aware and have the agenda in advance of the meetings too. All right. Well, that concludes our meeting for this afternoon, unless there's any other business that the stakeholder group members, the executive council members wish to note. I guess we can't really discuss it since it's not on the agenda. So if you're ready to adjourn, we can do so. And I just want to thank you all for your dedication and commitment and your leadership in the project. All of those of you who participate in these meetings on a regular basis, it all matters. And wish you all a happy holiday season.
Thank you.
Happy
holidays.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.
Saturday, more light. The solstice.
Mm-hmm. Something to look forward to.
Take care, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you.